headlines: Israeli forces kill at least three Palestinians during a night raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Myanmar's authorities open new corruption cases against ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other former officials from her government. And India reports the world's highest single-day death toll from COVID-19 after a big eastern state revised its total coronavirus-related fatalities. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Palestinian factions have slammed the Israeli regime for its latest onslaught in the occupied West Bank that left at least three people dead. In a statement, the Palestinian Authority warned that Israel's continued violation of rights would fuel more violence. Hamas and Fatah movements also condemned the raid and stressed the need for resistance against the regime's atrocities. Meanwhile, people took to the streets of the city of Jenin to express their anger at the overnight raid there. Two of those killed were intelligence officers from the Fatah movement, while the third victim was a member of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement. An Israeli soldier was also reportedly killed in the exchange of fire. The Israeli onslaught comes amid anger over the regime's planned evictions of Palestinian families and last month's deadly aggression against the Gaza Strip. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more details on the Israeli overnight raid in Jenin.
Well, what's known as the Yemen border police counterterrorism, this is what is called by the Israeli authorities, raided Jenin in order to conduct arrest campaign, in order to arrest Palestinians known for being wanted for security reasons. This means that those Palestinians are engaged in anti-Israel operations or activities or anything against the Israeli occupation. Our sources there said the Israeli forces took with them a Palestinian vehicle, and inside it there was Palestinians. Later it was revealed that one of the Palestinians who were wanted by the Israelis succumbed to his injuries, and he is Jamil Al-Amouri. He was a Palestinian activist belonging to Saray al-Quds from the Jihad movement. However, there are reports saying another Palestinian from the Jihad movement had been arrested during the operation, and we are speaking about a third Palestinian officer who is still in hospital in very serious conditions. Today, the funeral of those Palestinians would be taking place in Jenin. However, the funeral of the third Palestinian, of course, cannot take place, as the Israeli forces would remain keeping the body of the Palestinian from the Jihad movement.
Myanmar's military junta has brought new corruption cases against deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other former officials from her government. According to the state media, the cases are related to alleged misuse of land for a charitable foundation which Suu Kyi chaired, as well as earlier charges of accepting money and gold. These are the latest in a series of charges brought against her. Suu Kyi's supporters say the cases are politically motivated. She was overthrown in a military coup on February the 1st. The army accused the ruling party of voter fraud in the November elections, a charge rejected by the previous election commission and international monitors. Dozens of people have been killed, and hundreds of others have been jailed during protests against the military junta. Phil Robertson, the Deputy Asia Director of Human Rights Watch, says Myanmar's military is using excessive force to crack down on peaceful protesters.
Our assessment right now is that the Myanmar military is using excessive and lethal force in a systematic way against peaceful protesters all across the country. This is an ongoing human rights disaster, and the government is trying to cover this up with games being played, like charging Aung San Suu Kyi with various different criminal charges. These are charges that, in our view, are politically motivated, that really don't have much evidence to stand on, and will ultimately be heard by courts which are not independent. That the government, the military junta, to be exact, controls these courts and essentially will dictate what the courts come out with in terms of a final verdict. Quite clearly, there is a plan afoot by the Myanmar military junta to put Aung San Suu Kyi and her compatriots back behind bars, and possibly quite clearly, I think, to ban the National League for Democracy political party.
India has reported the world's highest daily coronavirus death toll, with 6,148 fatalities in the past 24 hours. The record deaths push India's confirmed fatalities to nearly 360,000. That after the state of Bihar revised its tally, adding 4,000 more deaths. The country's health ministry has also announced over 94,000 new COVID cases. With that, the total caseload in India surges past 29 million. India has been struggling with an aggressive new wave of COVID-19 for the past 2 months. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the coronavirus surge, but the South Asian country remains the second worst affected in the world after the United States in terms of infections. Our New Delhi correspondent Munawar Zaman says a severe shortage of coronavirus vaccines is India's biggest challenge these days.
The country has reported around 6,200 deaths, which is something highest the country has ever recorded. So yes, that's the area of concern. That's the biggest concern that is always there, because we in India, they want to make sure that the death toll remains as low as they can. But as we know, that the problem is with the healthcare facilities, there were oxygen problems, and of course the ventilator problems, the vaccination shortage. But in a lump sum, yes, there seems to be on ground, there seems to be a drastic change. The country has started unlocking in several states. Several states have announced the unlocking procedure with guidelines as well. They're not opening up instantly. They have started opening up in phases to make sure that they keep the COVID pandemic in check. Now, the biggest challenge that the country is facing right now is vaccinating its people. When the country is facing a huge shortage of vaccine, and the government is aiming at opening up vaccination program from the June 21, in which they have set targets to vaccinate every citizen above the age of 18. But many experts believe that this is going to be a phenomenal and a tremendous task for the country, because there is a lot of shortage of vaccination and the country's population is also massive.
The European Union's rights agency says the coronavirus pandemic has had an unprecedented and profound effect on human rights, calling for action by European countries. In its annual report, the EU Agency for Fundamental Rights says the pandemic and its reactions have exacerbated the challenges and inequalities, especially affecting vulnerable groups. The group says racist and xenophobic incidents have increased since the past year, targeting migrants and refugees. These groups are said to be at higher risk of contamination. The report also highlights a rise in domestic violence and sexual abuse, including online child abuse in 2020. The Vienna-based agency has urged countries to take measures to tackle the pandemic and its challenges to human rights. The report covers 27 EU members as well as North Macedonia and Serbia. The U.S. president warns Russia it would face, quote, robust and meaningful consequences if Moscow engages in what he described as harmful activities.
This is my first overseas trip as president of the United States. I'm heading to the G7, then to the NATO ministerial, and then to meet with Mr. Putin to let him know what I want him to know. It clear that the United States is back and democracies of the world are standing together to tackle the toughest challenges and the issues that matter most to our future. That we're committed to leading with strength.
Joe Biden was speaking at a British airbase housing U.S. troops. He did not reveal the nature of Russia's perceived harmful activities, but Washington has blamed Russia for alleged interferences in past U.S. elections, Washington also claims a number of recent ransomware attacks targeting the U.S. emanate from Russia. Biden said the U.S. is not seeking conflict with Russia, adding that Washington wants a stable and predictable relationship. He noted that the U.S.'s commitment to NATO is rock solid, but said the alliance needs to modernize and expand its cyber capabilities. Biden will meet Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva next week. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and political commentator Fred Weir, who's joining us from Moscow. Also, we have author and commentator John Stepling, who's with us from Inderøy, Norway. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Fred Weir in Moscow. Joe Biden said Russia would face robust and meaningful consequences if Moscow engages in what he described as harmful activities. That's as vague and as ambiguous as a comment could get. Help us unpack what the U.S. president said.
This is absolutely familiar, too. Both leaders are out there shoveling these kind of statements about how they're Putin is all about the red lines yesterday. And I think this is mostly for domestic consumption before the summit. They are both very, very eager to avoid the kind of fiasco that occurred in Helsinki 3 years ago, where Donald Trump was perceived as a Russian stooge and Putin got humiliated by the circus that took place in the media. They don't want that to happen again. I'm pretty sure this is a well-prepared summit that the experts have met. They've developed an agenda. They're playing it pretty close to the vest, so we don't know exactly what that will be. Probably there'll be talk of human rights and red lines and whatnot, but mainly one thinks it's about strategic stability, getting this spiral disintegration under control. I mean, it is a sobering thought that relations today are worse than they were at the worst moments of the Cold War. The back channels hardly exist. There's been virtually no dialogue, and the embassies on both sides are gutted. This is just insane. It can't go on. And so I think that their idea will be to impose some sort of management, at least on the process. They'll keep accusing each other of all the sins in the world. The confrontation will go on. The real geopolitical issues are there to still be solved if they can. But this kind of completely unpredictable chaos hopefully will end.
John Stepling, how do you perceive the comments, the recent comments coming from Joe Biden?
Well, certainly vague would be an understatement. It's actually almost amusing, whatever he might have meant by harmful activities. But we have been subjected to about 6 years or so of intense Russophobic propaganda coming out of the United States, from mainstream media, from the government, the State Department, from everybody, from the think tanks, places like Brookings and Cato Institute and so forth. And the media has manufactured a series of narratives all the way back to the Skirpal poisonings in Salisbury to the depiction of Alexei Navalny as some radical freedom fighter. And on and on. I mean, the list is long, and it even preceded that, of course. There's always been a decided anti-Russian bent to much of the U.S. government. And the Biden administration, he stocked his administration with Russophobes and liberal interventionists. And a lot of the people that were involved in the 2014 coup in Ukraine. So, this is the policy of the U.S. rarely changes. It's foreign policy, and it hasn't with Biden. It's not going to with Biden. You'll notice that, in spite of a different style, he's really just continuing Trump's policies. The U.S. would like to, I think, feel out and see what kind of leverage they can get vis-a-vis China if they can somehow interfere in the growing, you know, relationship between China and Russia, they would like to do that. They're worried about their own currency and the stability thereof. But look, the U.S. is building a naval base in Norway. They're having military exercises in the north of Sweden, both in the Arctic region. There's a massive NATO military exercise planned this summer. All of this targets Russia. There's been a great deal of saber rattling and a lot of belligerent, bellicose rhetoric coming out of Washington, out of Biden. Biden has always wanted to appear as a tough guy. That's one of his sort of style codes. So, you know, that's the lead up to this summit. But of course, as Mr. Weir said, an awful lot of this stuff is manufactured for domestic consumption. This is for the populace in Russia and the United States more than anything else. It's PR, it's spin, and you know, hence you get statements like the one Biden made that are just vague to the point of meaninglessness. So we'll see what happens.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Journalist and political commentator Fred Weir joining us from Moscow. Also thanks to author and commentator John Stepling speaking to us from Android. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of News Review. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned.
Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام أثقل ما يوضع في الميزان يوم القيامة الصلاة على محمد وعلى أهل بيته.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The heaviest thing to be placed on the scales on the day of resurrection is the invocation of blessings on Muhammad and his household."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed Imam, urged his companions to treat people according to Islamic etiquettes. Now, these Islamic etiquettes, which Imam al-Baqir urged his companions to follow and to inculcate within themselves, these social etiquettes, these Islamic etiquettes, in reality are a roadmap, a plan, a guide towards individual and social perfection. We can surely reach the utopian and perfect society which humanity has been pursuing since Adam, the very first prophet, if we inculcate and implement these divine laws, these divine commands, these divine prescriptions by the one who has created all of creation, Allah the Mighty, the Exalted. And so in one of these conversations, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, speaks in a conversation, in a dialogue with Jabir al-Jufi, one of his faithful companions and well-known and famous companions. Imam al-Baqir says to Jabir al-Jufi, "Be careful of postponement, for it is a sea in which the perished have drowned." Postponement, putting things off. Now, this postponement can be of many things. The first thing that comes to my humble mind is the postponement of asking for forgiveness, meaning to not ask for forgiveness. Sometimes we fall into this trap and we say, well, such and such auspicious occasion or special occasion is coming up, I will ask for forgiveness on that day. For example, I'll ask for forgiveness on the day of Hajj. Or I will ask for forgiveness on the 18th of Dhul Hajj, which is the Eid of Ghadir, the proclamation of the Wilayat, the authority of Imam Ali. Or, for example, I will ask for forgiveness on the day of Mab'ath, the day when the Holy Prophet was told to announce his prophethood to all.
Or, for example, I will ask for forgiveness in the month of Ramadan. Or I will ask for forgiveness on the 19th or the 21st of Ramadan. Or I will ask for forgiveness on the 23rd of Ramadan. Or maybe I will ask for forgiveness on the day of Eid, Eid al-Fitr, the first of Shawwal. There is no end, dear friends, to postponement. And the more you postpone something, the more you put something off, the more you will become drowned in this sea in which the perished have drowned. So do not postpone the forgiveness of your sins. And likewise, do not postpone, do not put off doing a good deed. Ask for forgiveness today, right now. Allah, forgive us our sins. And do the good deed today, right now. O Allah, bless us and endow us with doing good, honorable, righteous, and beautiful deeds for your sake. Beautiful words in this dialogue by Imam Al-Baqir.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
What was not discussed is now being discussed. What was given to the masses as the sunnah of the Prophet, which wasn't, is now being cleared up, is now being corrected. So all in all, what we can say is after a time of misinformation about the teachings of the Prophet, along with some information, the words of Ali ibn Abi Talib were around, the words of Imam al-Mujtaba were around, the words of Imam al-Husayn were around, but amongst a smaller group of people. The masses heard some of the words of the Prophet. They weren't all gone. Some of the words of the Prophet were truly passed on. There were people that received it. Later on, those were recorded. Those were not followers of the Ahlul Bayt, who do not try to get the knowledge of the Sunnah of the Prophet through the Ahlul Bayt, which is the source that the Prophet himself encouraged, although we don't say other sources, if reliable sources, that we're not going to hear what they have recorded. But these are the people that know it more accurately and know more of it, more details of it, and have understood it on a different scale. So if others share it, we check with the Ahlul Bayt. This is how we conduct ourselves. This is how we approach hadith. If Abdullah ibn Umar says that the Holy Prophet said something or another, you say, okay, Abdullah ibn Umar, according to history, was not seen to be a liar. We do not have that. He made mistakes, sure, but he was not one of the ones who fabricated. If he says he heard the Prophet say something, like, okay, we will see if it doesn't conflict with anything else. If it's in line with what the Ahlul Bayt have said, the Prophet has said, then okay, we'll accept the direction that it had without the input of Imam Zain al-Abidin, and then building off of that Imam al-Baqir, it would not have moved towards compilers of hadith, compiling these ahadith and trying to filter out the wrong, filtered out the ones that are not acceptable and taken and presented those which are acceptable. This would not have been the result of the direction of the Muslim community without the input of Imam Zain al-Abidin and afterwards Imam al-Baqir and specifically what we're focusing on here is Imam al-Baqir's effort.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprisings, directed by Maple Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Maurice McLeod, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organization Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and the corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the City Hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maghreb uprisings raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere, from the Arab Spring through Paris to Black Lives Matter.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system, which sent speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media embedded behind police lines portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me, people like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are two different versions of this film. And I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that, you know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking. The rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking?
And yeah.
That it's done with smartphones? And
exactly, yeah. It's shot on the fly, and you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version. We didn't get that. What it has and what really is its strength is that the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something, and in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many, about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square, about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine, but they're all big epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of process that you and your friends could organize, mm-hmm. or that you and your friends could, you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in. And that's a strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protest firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest. Mm.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, it was very bitty, but that's its nature and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but I that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd be a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I thought there could have been a little bit more to show how they were to how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, at the end of the Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. It's sort of you're plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That was intentional.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Which I guess, if it were a real protest, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions, and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for their need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and he even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on there's a quote where one of the protesters says, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learned that they've just been named European City of Culture. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. What we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with Mike said? And do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you were saying, in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC is saying about our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I rather than watching the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. So there's a lot in that. There's a lot in, let's get our own message across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that's certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of the film, in many ways, it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policemen liaising with the protesters and coming over to the protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonize the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator said that they came under attack and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protesters and started defending themselves. And she talks about love and the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, connected mm-hmm. to the people next to you, and that really came across. It didn't feel at all, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It was like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing. And that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way your authorities deal with what could be, perfectly reasonable protests ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. They're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, maybe in the interactive part this happens somewhere. It'd been nice to have seen more from the police, because there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to, was trying to converse with a police officer, he says, take your helmet off, come and talk to us.
I'd
like to have seen more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area. I'm always interested in what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone that one of their fellow citizens, and I think, you're violent and I'm going to hit you. How can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
You mentioned violence. I want to touch on that issue, because I think one of the questions the film raises is this issue of peaceful, artful protest or versus violent protest. Where do you weigh in on this debate?
Yeah, it's a constant thing, isn't it, to be honest? Whenever there's, when Ferguson happens, it's like, well, they've got a right to protest, but they haven't got a right to throw anything. And I feel like in my work, I'm constantly defending people's right to protest. And sometimes those protests get carried away because emotions are high and, actions and reactions, like we just said. Mm-hmm. I can understand. I thought the film did it quite well when it asked the question. It didn't say, violence, of course this should happen. It said, what's the difference between this person and that person? You went that way and they went that way, and they got caught up and threw a tear gas canister back and you didn't. So it tried to make a link, I think, between the protesters, whether they were violent or not violent. I thought that was kind of interesting, quite a brave thing to do for a documentary.
No, very clever.
It opens them up to criticism, I would imagine.
So it's not black and white, it's a complex issue with different layers.
A few days after the third uprising, the one we helped film, Mayor Kangler resigned and a candidate associated with the protests was elected mayor. Across Slovenia, 50 other towns organized uprisings under the slogan Gotovica, they're finished. The prime minister was swept up in a corruption scandal of his own, his coalition government collapsed, and he was voted out of power. So the initial demands of the uprisings were met, even exceeded.
So after all of that, it seems as though the protests didn't really work. Mike, are you convinced they had an impact?
Well, this is the surprise third act. We're talking about a three-act structure. Generally, these kind of protest movies end with some kind of flag-waving triumph, some sort of great note of hope that the audience can carry away with them. And what happens here is that the protesters meet their aims, but they do so in a way that they don't necessarily expect, and that's the big surprise of the film. So it's not this triumph. It is more of a sort of score draw that sort of they model through it. And what you get a sense of is the filmmakers trying to preserve everything that they've learnt in the course of the journey, in the course of the protest, so that future protesters can come out and see the film and have a sense of, well, you don't win every time. Sometimes you win in a way that you don't expect. Sometimes, you know, it's that old thing about life being the thing that happens when you're busy making plans. And this is absolutely reflected in the film.
And Maurice, what about, what do you think of this sort of ending towards of the documentary?
I thought it was successful, even though, not much changed in the lives of the protesters. I mean, that's the thing that leaves you thinking, well, what was it for? But as they said, they achieved all of their goals. Maybe their goals were too short term, you know, changing the mayor and, you know, removing the radar cameras. And
some of it seems a bit superficial, some of the changes, like a political reshuffle.
Yeah.
Do you think the film, therefore, has a wider message about lack of trust in the political establishment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was evident that you know, as the woman was saying there, they've replaced corrupt leaders with other corrupt leaders. But I felt that the documentary did mention this, that that's not the only point of the protest. It's also, it brought people together, it showed that they actually do have some agency and can affect change, even if it's only on a superficial level. You know, there was someone talking about the social, the community type changes that they felt had happened since the protest, that people felt more engaged with each other's lives and more involved. Someone's talking about family history that they started discussing since the protest. So I think that sort of stuff often gets ignored. You go, did you win or did you not win? You know, something just in coming together is important.
It's about, you know, I think we've been schooled to expect instant gratification. And I think one of the things that the film shows is that you can't have an easy win all the time. Sometimes it's a cumulative effect of small victories that build up to something that lasts, that's worthwhile. And I think that's the kind of victory that happens here.
And what other kind of wider lessons can we learn from this documentary, do you think, on the act of protest? Especially at a time like now, this political climate, where we see protests constantly.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I watched it thinking, what can I learn about protest? I don't know. I think it asks you questions. I think that's more what the documentary is. It says to you, what do you think about this? What do you think about violence? What do you think about this? What would make you uprise? Do you think this could happen? All those sorts of questions are really pertinent. I watched it and it made me explore thoughts that I was already having about protests and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's all very good, and it made me think about it from a context which I had no real connection to. I had no real connection to Maribor, or no real knowledge of their protests. So it was good looking at it from, you know, clearing out the emotion that maybe is in some of the protests that I do get involved in, like the Black Lives Matter stuff, clearing away some of that and going, okay, in this instance, this is how it happened. And like she said, I was amazed by how much it still felt very similar. It felt very familiar, and the reactions and the anger of the crowd, all of that is exactly the same. So I felt it did a very good job at getting that across. I don't feel like it was offering a judgment on protest. I don't feel like that was the point of it. I think it was more, the anatomy of a protest, or, you know, it was more explaining how it developed and ended up.
That's really interesting. So it's open to interpretation, and it's relative to everyone's experience. And Mike, final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
Certainly. I mean, I would very much now like to go and do the interactive version so I could sort of negotiate my way through the situation as it developed and see how things changed and how it changed my opinion as well. But as a starting point, it's well worth seeing.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave a comment and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.